Welcome to Donkey Kong Country. Here, apes who wear ties care only about where the next banana's coming from. It's a colourful and vibrant world, filled with wildlife. A far cry from the girders of the New Donk City building sites, where Donkey Kong himself first kidnapped Mario's girlfriend, in both characters' debut appearances. After a string of revolutionary arcade titles, the character was picked up by Rare, a company well known for their persistently high-quality games throughout the 1990s. Rare made the character one of gaming's most recognisable protagonists, and gave him breathtaking landscapes to explore across three critically acclaimed releases for the Super Nintendo. Like Mario, Donkey Kong has since splintered off into heaps of spin-offs, including the innovative Donkey Konga and a whole subset of puzzle games for handheld platforms. At the heart of them all is the groundwork that Rare laid for the universe, and they continued their own moulding of the series onto the Nintendo 64 for both Donkey Kong 64 and Diddy Kong Racing, which is often considered even stronger than its Mario Kart rival. When Rare's partnership with Nintendo dissolved in 2002, the character and his world were left floating in a limbo of side games and guest appearances. But his constant inclusion in series like Super Smash Bros. Showed his ubiquitous importance to the company. Eventually, it was decided that Donkey Kong would be most comfortable in his homeland, and fans received his best outing since the 90s with Donkey Kong Country Returns, a tight platforming experience with a loving reverence for Rare's SNES classics. We were only further treated with its sequel, Tropical Freeze, a certified masterpiece of the genre. One clear thread after all these years is Donkey Kong's music and audio in general. Many composers have left their mark as the series has evolved, but the DK sound has stayed recognisable since Rare established it. Thumping drums rumble beneath big band brass in its main themes, while more specific pieces are known for their lush and emotional tone. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in depth into video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. I spoke to some of Donkey Kong Country's most influential composers. David Wise.
Hi, it's me.
Is VGM royalty for his work on the series, guiding its sound from its beginnings to its very latest outing. Evelyn Novakovic, who I was only able to interview on the phone.
Right, I'm sitting down, I've got a cup of tea with me.
Was just as key to the DK sound, having contributed masses of music, sound effects, and even voice acting. In his second Sound Test appearance, I'm pleased to welcome back Grant Kirkhope.
Hang on, here we go. One, two. Hey, two, two. Yeah, there we go. Off it goes.
Whose career in VGM started with Donkey Kong Land 2 for the Game Boy. Of course, Grant went on to handle music for Donkey Kong 64, and it's a safe bet that you'll hear more than a few of his thoughts on the famous DK rap. The sheer size of Donkey Kong Country is imposing, as I'm sure comes across from this extra-long introduction, which still only skates the surface of an enormous subject. To begin this extravaganza, let's take a few steps back in time. Before Rare took on DK, they were already well respected for several favourites for Nintendo's first home console, the NES. This is music from Battletoads, which became a hit series itself for Rare. It's a tune that was written in 1991 by David Wise. Early hint into his ever-spiralling genius, its convincing guitar sounds and smart use of NES limitations are impressive to this day. But David had already been working in VGM for 4 years by Battletoads, kicking off his career with 1987's Slalom, also developed by Rare.
If we go back to the early days, I had a Roland MT32 which I used to compose on, and then This is when I first started at Rare, and then they said, well, you've got to get it onto the NES, and the NES was quite limited, and I was going to have to type it out as well. So that was quite a compromise, and if you listen to things like Slalom, by the time they got down to the NES, they sounded very basic and very compromised. But if you go through and find Time Lord on the NES, which is, I composed that probably a few years later, you can see how much progress we've made from a very static piece of music to actually giving movement. And that's the key to music, giving it movement, giving it a dynamic movement to make it work, really. And on Time Lord, you can really hear the circumnavigating the limitations of the system, really, to best effect. So even though there's only a few waveforms that we can have, if you scan through them very quickly, you suddenly get a different noise than if you just use one.
The NES, like consoles before it, and the SNES after it, used hex code as a basis for writing music. This meant that rather than actually playing anything in on keyboards or MIDI controllers, it was David's job to convert what he heard in his head into a long string of numbers. To make things harder, the NES was only capable of producing four channels of sound, essentially four instruments at any one time, alongside a fifth for lo-fi digital samples. Writing music in this way led to some unbelievable results, and you can hear more in depth about the process in an upcoming Commodore 64 special. So, when Donkey Kong Country came along, David Wise was already an established and respected force in the industry. He'd honed his approach and understood how to get the best results.
Obviously, when you play a game and play through the rough ones, you've always got an idea of what the tempo should be and what kind of style of music it is. So that very much dictates the type of music that you're going to hopefully create.
The Super NES, or the SNES as I've always called it, offered vast improvements for VGM composers, but was still very limited by modern standards. The upbeat brass that we all associate with the series would never have been truly possible on the NES. But what gave David the sense that it was right for Donkey Kong Country?
Well, there's lots of things that inspired it, because it's quite a collection of influences. But certainly, having played trumpet in a brass band, it's going to have a bearing. And also, I just bought a saxophone at the time, which was probably my biggest influence. And I was really into big band music at the time, and I thought a 1940s type swing band would suit Donkey Kong.
From those first fat rhythms of Jungle Hijinks, the game's opening level, David set out the DK sound magnificently. The track is actually three different pieces, which David wrote separately, stitched together in a way that almost tells a story. But he wasn't alone in telling that story. Evelyn Novakovic, who was credited with her maiden name Fisher, was integral to the music too. Without years in the industry, like David, as a safety net, Evelyn was brand new to composing VGM. So how did she get connected with Rare?
Well, I did an electroacoustic composition course at Bournemouth University, which is what sort of was the stepping stone to Rare. And I just wanted, I found putting images with music, with sound effects were, it was something that I really enjoyed doing, and this job came up with Rare, and I went for the interview, and I was lucky enough to get that. It was just as they were opening up their in-house music department, because before it had been Dave who'd been working in collaboration with them, but he was still freelance at that time.
Fresh to the scene and eager to learn, Evelyn couldn't have had a better teacher than David Wise, who helped guide her into the industry. Evelyn would soon carve out her own style, different to David's, and we'll hear some more about her sound later in this episode. But in her earliest days with Rare, David took on something of a mentor role.
He's a good guy, you know. He was a chuckle, really. It was a sharp learning curve for me because it's not something I'd ever done before. And when I had to put down the music for the SNES games, it was all programming in hex, and that was very, very new for me. So he was a good teacher, really. We got on really well. Our styles were very different, but you know, I knew that if ever there was anything that I was unsure about, you know, I would just have to ask. And he was always really helpful, you know, because he knew the system. He'd been working with computer games for a long time.
Making use of hex code for music is a far from intuitive process, but one that can actually be creatively inspiring. Evelyn eventually found it to be a comfortable and even liberating experience. What was the biggest challenge it posed when first taking on the job?
It was having to learn it. And having to learn the system was just very much different from anything I'd ever done before. And I was looking back at it again just the other day because I was thinking, in my head, I won't ever forget that 8 and 8 equaled, well, not 10, it equaled 1-0. And that used to mess with my mind because, you know, I would go around and just normal adding up. 8 and 8 automatically became 1-0. And, you know, you got so drawn into hex and using it day to day to day that actually, you know, it started seeping into everyday life. But no, it was a really... it was a system that I thought worked really well for music, actually, because it wasn't so... it allowed you a lot of free rein. You weren't tied to notation. You know, you could make it sound as fluid as you wanted to, just, you know, being able to program it in that way. Initially, I started writing music on paper or into the computer, and then I would try and transfer it. And actually, I realized bit by bit that writing the music directly onto the SNES worked really well. More difficult because you had to have the ideas sort of to put in, rather than sort of fiddling around trying to find something that was good. You know, you would put it in and then sort of listen to the result afterwards. But I think it worked really well. The very first piece that sort of made me realise just how powerful a tool it was when Dave did the water music. And as far as I remember, that went straight onto the SNES, and it was literally just using, you know, the ability to program into the tiniest notes, you know, and actually just getting this wonderful fluidity about it. And that had never seen a piece of paper. I think if you had to write it down, then it probably would never have sounded the same. So it was, that gave me an idea that, you know what, actually you can be really flexible with this machine.
Aquatic Ambience is probably among the best known and certainly the best loved pieces of video game music ever written. Brainchild of David Wise's relentless interest in experimentation, its fluid synths and bubbling percussion are perfect for Donkey Kong Country's underwater levels. Beyond how well it matches the on-screen action, it's hard to believe that its gorgeous tones were even possible on the SNES. The track sums up precisely what makes the DK sound on that console so important, seemingly skipping a generation, or even two, in its sophistication.
That was all my experimentation. I'd spent weeks trying to get the type of, let me see, waveform sequencing going, really, where we're going from one wave to the next, but we're doing it rhythmically. And there was a lot of experimentation involved, because we we don't have MIDI, we have to type it in. So you don't really want to waste too much time, yet there needs to be a certain amount of experimentation, otherwise you're never going to push a system forward. And that inherently has a certain amount of risk, because if the experiments don't pay off, then it looks as though you've wasted a bit of time. But if they do, and you know, before I try anything like that, I've always got an idea of what it should sound like if it all works. And that was one of those where it all started coming together, so there was lots of inspiration bubbling behind that. It kind of all started to work. There's a combination of things. So with the string sounds, I'd got a small loop that worked and sounded like an analog string sound, and I was quite pleased that was working. And then we got the analog waveform sequencing in the background, which is the bass line, and it gave a good pulse. It sort of matched the action on the screen. So that's where that was from, and also I suppose it's how you're feeling at the time, but you know, that was a long time ago, so I can't quite remember that.
And after all these years, Aquatic Ambience is still impressive. It's become a signature piece in David's catalogue, whose style shines through in the music of any game he composes for. But what of Evelyn's style? Except for some key tracks, like Candy's Love Song, Evelyn's contributions were more atmospheric in their feeling. A strong example is something like Voices of the Temple, where contemplative flutes mix with dark drones and melodic plucks.
At that stage, I found atmospheric that much more natural to me. It was more my natural style anyway. It was trying to give a feeling of the place you were in, trying to get a sense of the momentum that you needed to get through the level, and it just was naturally the sort of thing I did. Dave, he produced the pieces that had you sort of, you know, bopping along in a sense, sort of jigging about really, and my stuff was much, much more atmospheric, and I think it always has been naturally that way anyway. But at the time, I didn't go, oh, I'm trying to go for a certain sound. No, at the time, I wanted to create that soundscape. I wanted to create a feeling of, you know, momentum, and just continue what I felt was the right thing to do.
Evelyn's music gave Donkey Kong Country an extra mystery and tension, just right for the tribal treetops and frozen caves it underscores. But one of her bounciest tracks has gained an iconic status in the series as a map theme. Came back with new arrangements for Donkey Kong Country Returns and Tropical Freeze, and could be heard in the background of Smash Bros. Brawl battles. Having not written any new music for games in over 10 years, Evelyn remains remarkably humble about her work.
It's funny actually, I sort of think that this is decades ago, she says, adding it up. It is decades ago, and you know, I find it strange now to be hearing any discussion about the Donkey Kong series. This is the funny thing. You know, I did something I loved, and luckily it was a job that I loved, and I enjoy doing it. And it's brilliant to think that actually it's touched people. I've had people contacting me from, you know, the other side of the world, sort of wanting to say something. And it's just like, wow, you know, I was just a musician. Nothing more than that.
Though Evelyn naturally adopted a more atmospheric style, one of David's contributions is an interesting exception. Cave Dweller Concert is arguably the most minimal piece from Donkey Kong Country's soundtrack, hinging on a single marimba, sparse drums, and ghostly, isolated synths.
A lot of that was driven by Tim Stamper, who was the artistic director at Rare, and he wanted to keep it minimal. He wanted it to sound like a cave, because you don't really you don't really know what's going to happen when you walk into a dark cave. It's there's kind of a lot of suspense, so we try to keep it as suspenseful as possible, hence the minimalism there. But we probably tried several ideas before we got to that, and I think we just kept stripping away until we found something that was that was working with the graphics and the type of feeling that we were trying to create in that particular level.
Tim Stamper and his brother Chris were the main forces behind Rare until 2006. Across my interviews for this series, composers who worked for the company regularly cite them as creative powerhouses and a constant inspiration. It seems they took a hands-on approach to the music of their games, with just enough balance to trust their musicians with incredible freedom. This is why so many scores to Rare titles feature extra elements, like wildlife singing along. In Donkey Kong Country, many tracks incorporate sound effects as a part of the tunes. It's particularly noticeable in Cave Dweller Concert, and I'd always wondered what led to that approach.
Well, it was, again, Tim Stamper. He was very instrumental in suggesting those as ideas. We couldn't really have a separate ambience or separate sound effects and a separate tune because we just didn't have the bandwidth for it, really. There's 8 monophonic channels and there's 8 sort of sample channels that you can play with. So to have a separate... To dedicate a certain amount or a certain percentage of the audio just to do the sound effects or the ambience isn't really going to work. So the only way we managed to do it was to incorporate it into the tunes, and then you kind of kill 2 birds with 1 stone. So the ambience is rhythmic as well in its nature. It's going along, and so it's helping to support the gameplay, really, and how it bounces along the level too. So it was a nice accident, really. It was a way of getting past a limitation and making it something more than it would have been.
There was something very special about Rare in the 90s, and you hear it time and time again from anyone affiliated with them. In all departments, you could tell that the people behind Rare's games were in a nurturing, expressive environment. It's instantly audible in Donkey Kong Country's music, and particularly Evelyn's, who had only just started in VGA. You wouldn't guess from listening to her work, as Rare gave her all the tools, and importantly, space, that she needed to prove her abilities.
You know, I love my time at Rare. I don't think I had really any point where I thought, oh, why am I doing this? You know, we did it for the love of it, for the love of the music, for the enjoyment of the computer games, and it was brilliant, just trying to push the system a little bit further, trying to push ourselves, to be honest. In my case, as I say, I hadn't come from a video game background at all, and it was a step in the dark for me, so it was a challenge as well. So it was lovely to be able to do things like that. We were generally left to do what we were able to do. You know, there was no, there's no dictating from up on high. It was a case of, look, you know what you're doing. You know how to do the job. This is the sort of thing that we would like. And then just allowed us to get on with it. And it was brilliant. It was a lovely introduction for me, actually, into the computer game world, because I felt it was a really good starting point for me, and I loved my time at Rare, I really did.
Like every area of the company, Rare's audio consistently went to the next level. In the broader picture, even Donkey Kong Country is just one example of their attention to detail. Evelyn and David both talked about pushing the system forward when I spoke to them, and it's obvious to any player how sincere they were about it. What exactly made them and their contemporaries at Rare so driven to innovate?
If you can imagine, you've got a Super NES and you've seen all the guys, what they're doing with the graphics, and they've got these huge machines that were upwards of 80,000. One of them was 500,000, about two of them were. And they're doing all this pre-rendered stuff and it looks amazing. It looks like nothing you've ever seen before. It looks, by comparison, as though you could pick the characters up from the screen and put them in your hand. And this is all on a 16-bit system. So I was aware that we were doing something very special, so I decided that I'd like to try something different with the audio and try and create something that was hopefully equally as impressive as the graphics, and that was a lot of the driver.
Before we move on to the next game in the series, Diddy's Conquest, who can forget Robin Beanland? Another of Rare's magnificent band of top-tier VGM composers, Robin's credits include Killer Instinct, GoldenEye 007, Conker's Bad Fur Day, and most recently, Sea of Thieves. He was responsible for the infectious Funky's Fugue. Interestingly enough, Funky's Fugue was first written for Killer Instinct, and can be heard in some very old promo videos for the title's arcade release. It's Robin's sole track in the whole DK series, which is understandable when you see the expansive list of other games he worked on. Donkey Kong Country's soundtrack will always be thought of among gaming's most forward-thinking, leaving many of its rivals scrambling to play catch-up. But Diddy's Conquest, the sequel, the music kept that momentum going. Only in games are sequels so regularly a good thing, and Diddy's Conquest proves it. A bad review is nigh on impossible to find, and it seems universally agreed that Rare's second outing into Donkey Kong Country was a resounding success. Personally, I played Donkey Kong Country at friends' houses, but it was Diddy's Conquest that I owned and cherished as the release that made me love platformers. For this title, David took on the music alone. Evelyn would soon return to compose for Donkey Kong Country 3, but the second installment was left purely in David's hands. He brought his ongoing love for experimentation back into the fold too, filling many of the tracks with layered instrumentation and strikingly deep sounds. In particular, the waveform sequencing that led to aquatic ambience is mastered throughout the score. You can't miss it on tracks like Forest Interlude, which sounds more like the Korg wave station that inspired it than the Super Nintendo.
On the second game, it was just more of we got a stack for the sample, so we got a 5K stack, and it sounds like, you know, it's just a few K of memory, but it made a big difference. It meant we could put different samples in and out. And it meant the sonic palette had just increased from just being a straight 64K to probably having a float of 32 or 40K extra that we could bump in and out of the level as we went from one level to the next. And so that extended the palette that we had to use, and that gave a lot of extra flexibility. You you've got to remember the time that it was written, in the fact that everything was on cartridge. There weren't CDs, really. They were just coming into force. But what we were working with, especially on the Super NES, was we were working with a cartridge-based system. So it really was trying to get the best out of that cartridge-based system, and everybody who was composing music for it had the same limitations. So even now, I still want to get the very, very best out of the equipment that I've got. So it was nice to really get into the minute details to try and... Because we always did that at Rare, you know, whether it was graphics or gameplay or anything, we always tried to push the boundaries, really, to see what we could get away with.
Though David's music was just right for the SNES, it even sounded good when converted to the much more limited Game Boy. Every Donkey Kong Country title for the Super Nintendo had a handheld equivalent, with Land replacing Country in their names to help differentiate them. First Donkey Kong Land featured converted and brand new music from David Wise and Graham Norgate, who's well known as another of Rare's top composers from the 90s, and later went on to handle Time Splitters and Crisis. While the SNES allowed for 8 separate tracks of audio within one piece, or basically 8 instruments, the Game Boy could only use 4. One of those was a noise generator, which usually approximated drums. In the Donkey Kong Land games, the music always pushes through these constraints, and their soundtracks have a dedicated pocket of fans. For Donkey Kong Land 2, which used Diddy's Conquest as a springboard, Rare brought Grant Kirkhope aboard.
The reason maybe the Game Boy sounds good is because is testament to how great Dave's composing was for the game. It, you know, when you write great, I kind of feel if you write a great tune, you can do anything you like with it. You can have it on a kazoo and it sounds great. Dave's writing them was spectacular, I think. It was all Dave. There's nothing on the Game Boy that was on my stuff. That was all his. I just converted his tunes. Like, that was my first job at Rare. So, honestly, there was nothing for me in that game. It was totally Dave. I mean, Dave's tunes in that game are awesome. I think the Diddy Kong's Quest, the second DKC's, I think that's Dave's best. That's Dave's best DK from that era. From the first game, the aquatic ambience is absolutely fantastic, but I loved the second game. It had that parody theme to it. I thought he did a brilliant job on that game.
Now, Grant's name is familiar to practically all fans of VGM, but like Evelyn, Donkey Kong represented his earliest steps into the industry. As listeners who have heard the previous Banjo-Kazooie episode of this series will know, strong melodies come naturally to Grant. Donkey Kong Land 2 might not have given him the chance to show that right away, but it does put a spotlight on his careful ear. Having to strip back the tunes to their most important elements, while still making it sound complete and enjoyable, is no small task, and Grant was learning much of the equipment from scratch.
You know, when I first got to Rare, right, my first job was that, right, and Dave came to show me how it worked, and it was pretty complicated, and it wasn't what I was used to. It wasn't MIDI files in Cubase, it was all done in hex, on a black computer screen, typing in numbers. That's how it worked. There was no actual MIDI file note composing. It was all in numbers, which for me was like completely alien. I had no idea what I was doing. And so he showed me that. I just panicked and thought, I'm going to have to resign. I can't do it. I got him back the second day to show me again. I said, Dave, just do it again. Let me write down each step one at a time. So I wrote them down, like step one, press this, step two, press that. And he showed me how it all worked. And I guess at the start, I was like, oh my God, I don't really want to do this. But by the end of it, I really quite enjoyed it.
We should be thankful, considering his music since, that Grant kept going. Indeed, a struggle can't even be heard in Donkey Kong Land 2, which manages to compress the majestic soundtrack of Diddy's Conquest into a truly memorable handheld conversion. It wasn't simply a case of resequencing a melody either. The Game Boy's audio, which has much in common with the NES, boasts a lot of its own methods to bypass limitations.
It was the same thing where I tried to push the Game Boy to as far as it could go to try and make it sound half decent, you know what I mean? So whether that made a difference, I don't know. But that's the approach I took to it. I really enjoyed it in the end. I tried to make it as full as possible. And there's lots of little tricks that Dave showed me to simulate reverb, because there's no actual echo on the Game Boy, but you can make it sound like it has. Because like you'd play a note, play the next note, and you'd play the first note lower volume, so it sounded like it was echoing. Quite a tricky technique, but Dave, I don't know whether he invented it, but he showed it to me. And I used that all over the place, because it made it a fuller sound, but it was like a pain in the ass to program, obviously.
These are the things that make a lot of older game soundtracks so compelling. With each system and each generation, new technology opened up different doors and opportunities to wring out every last bit of processing power possible. The SNES, which let composers actually use the reverb that Grant worked hard to simulate, similar inventive shades were applied in other areas. Like the waveform sequencing of aquatic ambience, a lot of the SNES's trickery hinged on the creation of singular instruments or sound effects.
Well, we only had a very limited sound set, so things like the Guiro. If you take the Guiro down to its smallest part, it makes a really short sound like a k, and then if you put those together, you get the Guiro sound, and the same goes for bird sound effects as well. But then you can recreate them, you can put different pitches on them, or pitch sweeps on them, and that will recreate a different sound. So although it's not the same one, it's a very unique and individual sound that's been basically resynthesized and re-sequenced back together. And then, because everything was subroutines, I could do that. I could just call it what I needed to and fire it off. And that was a bit different from working with MIDI. So on the Super NES, that worked quite well.
The craft of sound effects is a massive subject on its own, and an art form that can take a lifetime to fully understand. In games, sound effects are usually taken on by the composer, while films or television employ focused Foley artists. I've always felt it was a lot to put on the shoulders of a musician, but it turns out that many composers enjoy it. Though not involved in the SNES release of Diddy's Conquest, Evelyn returned to the series for its Game Boy Advance port, specifically to craft its noises and sounds. This time, the practice wasn't entirely new to her. It's a role she'd previously taken on the first Donkey Kong Country, and it also followed her into her work for Dixie Kong's Double Trouble, the third home console installment.
I have worked on sound effects on and off for so many different games. I would have done, including obviously the original sound effects that would have gone down the line to DK3. And then I did sound effects right through till the very end. I mean, I was at Rare until 2007, and I did the sound effects for Cameo. So that was just something that I became more and more and more involved in, because for me, personally, I love the fact that you can create a soundscape for the player, you know, and it's all about sucking the player in and making them believe they're in the world you're showing them. And I think sound and music perform an equally important role in doing that. And so I really, really love doing sound effects, ambiences, you know, the music as well. But I just found that I had that drive to create this soundscape. And you could see that sort of as we got to Cameo. I really loved doing that.
Donkey Kong Country's sound effects are just as vibrant as its music, and encouraging you to find every last stashed banana and secret. But like music, every composer has an individual approach. When it comes to Evelyn's career with sound effects, the DK series is just the tip of the iceberg. Over the years, has there been any specific processes that she's stuck to when creating them?
Well, it differs. I mean, you have two different options. You can either go out to the field and you can record, and it's knowing that a certain sound would be appropriate for something, even if it doesn't relate to it at all. So, for example, I suppose the closest you get is in horror movies, for example. Someone might go chopping up cabbages to get that really nasty cutting a person's neck off type sound effect. You know, you have to be able to imagine a sound in the real world that would work as something totally different. And we had great fun doing that. You know, and we equally had libraries of sounds that we could layer up. So, for example, you know, if there was a certain sound that had to be really, you know, really unusual, you're not going to just pick a sound that's, say, an everyday object and go, oh, that will do. You can layer it up in so many different ways that actually that first sound you started with, nobody's got any clue that it's in there. So it's brilliant. It gives you a huge amount of flexibility, and it is a creative process and it's an imaginative process. There is so much that you can do. I mean, I cringe now when, you know, you're sitting there watching TV and then you can hear the same sound effects time and time and time and time again. You think, okay, well, that comes from that library and that comes from that library. I mean, initially, you know, when we started at the very beginning, we would do a lot of library work. But as I say, it was then turning it into your own, because it's a very, I think, it's a very lazy way just to go, oh, this is a really nice sound that I think would work, and just plop it in. It's what you do with that sound, I think. And, you know, as I said, in my case, is how I would layer it up and try and get it as far away from the original sound as possible. And then going out and recording bits and pieces, you know, that was fun in itself, just trundling out and about, because we had such huge grounds at Rare that, you know, you could just literally walk about recording the various different sounds and then using those afterwards.
Donkey Kong Country 3, Dixie Kong's Double Trouble, was an excellent playground for Evelyn's sound effects and music. The game is often credited as a collaborative effort between her and David, but David composed less than a quarter of its soundtrack. DK's musical legacy hadn't had time to grow by 1996, when Double Trouble hit the shelves. So how much did Evelyn feel intimidated by the venture?
At the time, I just did it because, you know, I'd been asked to. I didn't have too much baggage, in the sense that I didn't sort of feel, oh, I'm taking on something that everybody knows. But then maybe that's because I was still quite new to the company. And maybe I didn't really appreciate how big these things were for the wider audience. And maybe nowadays I'd be a little bit more sort of, ooh. but at the time, it was okay. Oh, yeah, okay, it's a challenge. I'll do it. Why not?
Critics were initially divided over Evelyn's soundtrack, but any short dip into the comments section of its music on YouTube would bring up hordes of fans who actually grew up playing the game. Many of them argue it is the finest sounding title from the SNES days, and jump directly to its defence at any suggestion that it might not have hit the mark. Double Trouble was a different game, with a largely different cast of characters. Evelyn scored the Northern Cremosphere with depth and passion. She even took the reins on Double Trouble's Game Boy counterpart, Donkey Kong Land 3.
You had to strip away a lot of probably what made the music recognisable, because you had so few channels to do it in. So you somehow had to piece together the music within the reduced number of channels and still make it sound the same, in a way, And I vaguely remember going through time and time again of trying to actually get it to be right. It wasn't an easy task, because firstly, as I say, you have to strip away so much of the music, and then leave in the bits that you think really, really made the tune what it was. But no, when it worked, it was brilliant, because I think the Game Boy was fun. It was a different team altogether who worked on it, and they worked pretty much solely on Game Boy stuff. So again, it was nice working for a different team as well. But it was hard trying to get that music down and trying to do it justice.
The fact that Double Trouble came out months after the release of the Nintendo 64 was unfortunate timing that affected its sales. Double Trouble was part of a group of games that never truly got the attention they deserved, as players flocked to the fresh pastures of a new console. N64 owners would have to wait 3 years for another platformer in 1999's Donkey Kong 64, but the delay was made easier by Diddy Kong Racing. Though technically not a Donkey Kong Country release, and without an appearance from Donkey Kong himself, it's within the same universe, developed by Rare, and graced with a soundtrack of original David Wise tunes. As a racing game, how did he adapt the DK sound to the genre?
What Diddy Kong Racing was really about was trying to make it sound more Mario Kart than Mario Kart. Trying to make it sound, because we didn't have much use of the internet then, it was still early days for that, especially over at Rare. Trying to make it sound like a holiday program, because I used to like watching holiday programs. And also to try and really hone in on cliches. So every time you hear a piece of music, especially from Disney, they really go for the cliches. They probably set a few of those cliches up. And it was nice to choose instrumentation that lends itself to instantly recognizable cliches as far as the music goes. So we were always looking for those sort of fun type of instruments and sounds. And it was just, I don't know, it's just having fun really with the music to make it either, I don't know, sound more Mexican or more Spanish, to really push the almost the cheesiness of it, but to a cheeky effect rather than trying to sound, predictable. So it was really trying to pick out the element of what makes those tracks fun.
Music and game in general achieved Rare's goal to provide a strong rival for Mario Kart, and Diddy Kong Racing ended up as N64's 8th best-selling title. Fans were satisfied with the game for its own qualities, but there was a growing intrigue around the series' true platforming continuation. Donkey Kong 64 was first teased online with a single image, and then dropped just in time for the Christmas of 1999. Hot off the heels of completing the music for Banjo-Kazooie, Grant Kirkhope was called for another visit to Donkey Kong Country. Much more comfortable with the N64 than the Game Boy, and able to compose rather than just convert, Grant produced a soundtrack of simply enormous size.
I always think to myself, I don't know how I do it, and my wife says to me, yeah, how do you just keep writing music? And I really don't know. I really don't know, I've got no idea, and it just keeps coming out, and I just keep thinking, at some point it's just going to dry up, I'm just going to be like a prune, you know. It just seems to keep coming, and that year was particularly hard, because I was doing Banjo-Tooie, DK64, and Perfect Dark at the same time. So I don't know how I did it, really. And I tried to make DK64 darker than Banjo, because I was doing two platform games at the same time. I thought, I've got to make them different somehow. And I did feel like it was a darker game. And I felt like DK even Dave's soundtracks in general are a darker sounding soundtrack than, say, Banjo was. So I kind of felt I kept it in that direction, I felt.
Grant provided hours of music for Donkey Kong 64, which included cutscenes, cues, individual level tracks, and several dynamic variations for different areas. Yet, many fans forget that hard work in favour of one lone song. Of course, I'm talking about the DK rap, which opened up the game and has gone on to repeated name drops in clickbait articles about VGM's apparent worst tunes. At this point, lazy writers are just copying and pasting an archaic misinterpretation, where whole generations missed the point.
At the time, no one really liked it, and I was like, oh God, I've been a right mess of that. Because no one really got it. It's supposed to be a joke, and no one got the joke except me, unfortunately. So, I've got to say, it's really heartwarming, the amount of people that love the DK rap now. My son's 15 and a half, right, and all his friends came around for his birthday, like, in September last year. And they were sat having the cake and whatever, and they all started chanting the DK rap for me. And they all knew the words. And none of them were born when it was out, you know. It's really one of those things where, I don't know, it's super flattering and heartwarming that it's... People think it's funny now and laugh at it, I guess it echoes back to the childhood. Like you say, they play it when they're kids and they remember it forever. And I think the DK rap's one of those things that people played it and just, you know, they all knew the words when they were like 7 years old, 8 years old. The kind of young generation who weren't hip just thought it was good fun. The kids a bit older thought, oh God, this is like bad rap, which it is, you know.
Whatever generation you were in, and whatever your opinion, the DK rap is an icon of VGM culture. Saving me the need to cover how it was created, Grant was more than forthcoming when I asked him about it. For a tongue-in-cheek parody track, masses of thought and collaboration fueled it.
George Andreas, who was the lead designer on the game, wrote the lyrics. His idea was a much faster track. I think a bit like that Run DMC Jason Nevins thing that was out years ago. I think he felt like it's going to be a bit more like that, but I didn't see it that way. So I thought it'd be better slower. So him and Chris Sutherland did the rapping because nobody else could do it. No one wanted to do it. And I got, for the chorus, I got in the banjo lads of the banjo team, which were probably like Steve Mayles, Greg Mayles, Chris Peel, maybe Ed Bryan, maybe Chris Sutherland again, just for the chorus chant. And that was it. And I played guitar on it. I did the electric guitar myself and the guitar part on it. The bass is synth. I found the drum beat on I had a Roland JV-1080, and it had you could put extra expansion cards in it, and it had like some kind of hip-hop expansion card or pop expansion card. And I found that drum beat on there. So I thought, oh, that's all right. It must be hip. It's on a synth that I've got. It must be pretty hip. So I just used that. Each character had an instrument. So, you know, so Diddy Kong had a guitar. I felt like a big timpani drums for Funky Kong, the big one, you know, because he's a bit stupid and heavy. DK had the trumpets because I felt that was part of Dave's tune, that kind of the way Dave's music sounded, that kind of old-time Charleston-esque, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah, so I just kind of put instruments with what I thought would fit. I put the baritone sax with Tiny Kong. I don't know why I did that, but I kind of felt it fitted her. I was pretty chuffed with that. I thought, oh, it sounds great. And then, of course, it came out, everyone went, oh, my God, this is awful. So didn't go so well when it came out. But I guess it's taken, you know, 8 to 20 years for people to like it, but they seem to like it now.
Over time, reception toward the DK rap has gotten notably warmer. It showed up in Smash Brothers, only with a new, updated recording. As the youth who played Donkey Kong 64 enter adulthood, they can only hear it and smile. those who disregarded it have come to understand its intentions better, and that it's still talked about says something of its impact.
Someone sent me one of those. There was like a speedrun or maybe a, no, it was a Smash Brothers tournament, I think, on in Australia somewhere. And they sent me the clip where DK was on and someone in the front of the audience, it was probably like 300 or 400 people in the room, and someone in the front of the audience started singing the DK rap and everybody joined in.
The entire time, three of you have to deal with it.
Oh my God.
Alright.
Okay.
Okay.
We got something. Yo, this crowd is so nice.
This crowd, I love it.
I'm not joking, I sat and I cried watching it. Couldn't believe it that people were like, you know, chanting the DK rap, but it lasted all this time. You know, it's been, you know, I mean, if all the music that I write, I bet that's the thing that I get remembered for. Like, you know, on my gravestone, it'll be like, here lies Grant Kirkup, he wrote the DK rap, you know, bastard. No, you know, looking back, it's fantastic that it's endured so long and people seem to have a good laugh with it these days, so it's all fine with me.
David Wise may have had no hand in the audio of Donkey Kong 64, but Evelyn can still be heard in an unexpected way. Cast as the voice of Tiny, her samples were even recycled for Dixie in the Game Boy Advance remake Diddy's Conquest. Evelyn had already provided vocals for Pipsy the Mouse in Diddy Kong Racing, and would advance to her most recognisable role in the year 2000 as Perfect Dark's Joanna Dark. With composition and sound effects already under Evelyn's belt, how did voice acting become a part of her work too?
Because we were part of a close-knit music department, any audio job going, we would do those ourselves, certainly in the early days. And it was a case of, right, okay, you've got the squeakiest, highest voice.
Tiny.
You're going to do this, you're going to do that. And then you get drawn in. We'd be doing our own games or whatever it was, and you get drawn in. It's like, yep, no, you'd be perfect for that. Do a few squeaks for me. And, you know, it was all really in-house, right up to Perfect Dark. And again, it was a case of, right, okay, we need a female voice actor. All of the characters were done in-house for Perfect Dark. But basically, it was a case of, you're part of the music department, we need you now, you can come and go, and if we need to have anything re-recorded, you're there, you're on site. So it made sense for us to do that.
Sadly, Donkey Kong 64 would be Rare's final totally original game in the series, and Grant left things on a high note with a sprawling track list of catchy melodies. Strangely, the company still had one original soundtrack up its sleeve. Donkey Kong Country 3's re-release on the Game Boy Advance came with an entirely new score from David Wise. Some technical issues with converting Evelyn's music actually made it easier to compose tunes specifically tailored to the GBA's hardware. It's relatively obscure, and the least known of the DK soundtracks, but an authentic appendix to the legendary catalogue that led to it. In 2002, Rare were acquired by Microsoft, and Donkey Kong entered the age of the spin-off. Some of those games were great fun, but none approached the care, detail, or even genre of Rare's take on the series. As a fan since childhood, I never thought I'd see their like again, but always hoped they'd be revived. Come 2010, my wish was granted with Donkey Kong Country Returns. It shares some staff in common with the SNES's trilogy of platformers, but this release was otherwise developed by Retro Studios. Their interpretation of the series was faithful, loving, and creative in its own right, featuring new and rearranged music by Kenji Yamamoto and a team he supervised. Kenji Koji Yamamoto has contributed much to VGM through the Metroid series and more, having started way back in 1987 with Punch-Out. His version of the DK sound tickled at fans' retro sensibilities, but kept firmly in mind that it was more than just a nostalgia trip. Donkey Kong Country Returns showed Nintendo that there was still a contemporary desire for more from the series, by performing well both critically and commercially. For its follow-up, Tropical Freeze, Kenji Yamamoto and his team added David Wise himself to the audio department. His presence legitimised the already sharp accuracy of the reboot series. But how did David feel about coming back after so long?
Oh, brilliant. It was like returning to the fold, doing some more stuff for Nintendo. It was great. Really enjoyed it. Great fun to work on. And it was nice to go back and further develop where it kind of probably left off about 20 years previously. Very liberating. But at the same time, it's amazing how much processing you have to throw at something nowadays to make it sound just like a SNES did then. I'm using two computers, both with 12 cores, running at about 4 gigahertz each processor. And they were maxed out for the Tropical Freeze ones.
True triumph of Tropical Freeze's music, its ability to reference old classics without it feeling like a tired gimmick. Plenty of the game's new arrangements of past tunes spiral into their own thing and then back again. Nothing sounds retro for the sake of it, and the magic of those previous titles' audio is captured once more along the way.
Not to sound conceited, I thought we got it right for the Super NES, so it was really trying to recreate it in the same type of style, but also retold for our time. So it needed to sound better sonically, but I didn't want to destroy the music either, because I thought it supported the type of gameplay that we were going for. So no trepidation, it's just beavering away until you've got it right, really.
Tropical Freeze has plenty of its own tracks that were composed just for it, many of which slot right beside the legacy they followed. Fans have strongly gripped onto Grassland Groove, to name just one, as a favourite. It sounds exactly how you'd imagine Donkey Kong Country 2 in the 21st century. Its production shows how well David fit into the team from Returns.
There's quite a lot of staff over in Japan, in the Kyoto offices, and some of them sing in a choir, quite a large choir, and so he'd have this great idea to utilise the staff over in Kyoto to do some of the vocals, and I think they made just a fantastic job of it. It's so unique and interesting. So we've taken sort of these stock ideas that are available, and they've turned it into something else. And I think it's just a joy to listen back to it every time. I still laugh, because it really is quite, and I mean laugh in a good way. You know, when you hear something that's good, I always smile. And every time I hear it, it's great. It's a joy to listen to for me.
In the end, Tropical Freeze turned out to be my favourite 2D platformer in nearly a decade. It's an opinion many share too, and its recent re-release on the Switch will keep new audiences hearing its music for some time. It also has me tentatively awaiting a third game in the Returns series, and many have wondered if such a title would ever bring Evelyn Novakovic back in a similar way. Both Returns and Tropical Freeze incorporate her work into the overall palette, and there's a definite fan demand for her inclusion. Of course, Evelyn would have to be on board herself, so I asked her if she'd be interested in the prospect.
I've never really thought, is it something that I would do again in the future? I guess, maybe. You know, I don't know. I think computer games have moved on so dramatically now. Part of me wonders whether it'd be a really scary process to do that, having been away for so long. And technology has moved on in such a big way. But that doesn't mean to say, oh, no, I would never do that. I don't know. I really, really can't answer that for definite.
A third Donkey Kong Country Returns with Evelyn and David together is unlikely, but would be a definite dream come true. Outside of future speculation, we already have 6 main series titles, a whole second life on handheld systems, a racing game, and truckloads of spin-offs. Across it all, the franchise has maintained its reputation for ingenious trailblazing, melodic mastery, and evocative atmospheres. Each of the many composers who left their stamp on Donkey Kong Country has a different way of expressing themselves, but that just left the releases with a wider, more interesting scope. Playing them is an unforgettable experience, and the path is clear for the character to pound on with banana-crazed acrobatics for as long as Nintendo likes. I get the feeling that Donkey Kong Country is far from fully discovered, but the Uncharted lands are bound to sound great at least.
I think actually, look, when you look at the series in its entirety, actually, there was a sound that really worked. It was a fun series to work on, and it was so upbeat. You know, it couldn't help but put a smile on your face. And I loved the fact that I was able to do so many different things musically. I really look back at that time and think, I had a great time. I really, really did enjoy it. And it was so good being part of the team, and we were all, you know, the creative juices. It was brilliant. It was absolutely fantastic.
Most important to set the rhythm of the level and to try and give a player an indication of how fast he should be rolling along through the level. So I think if you listen to Mario, which is obviously the iconic one from the NES days, it's fun and it's bouncy and it makes you want to progress through the level at that kind of pace. And I think that's really what the music was doing.
I always say this little daft thing, but like for any artist of any persuasion, whether you're a photographer, a writer, composer, you name it, for anybody to like anything that comes out of your head is like amazing. If it's one person in the world that likes that thing you produced out of your brain, that is like just fantastic. For people to like the stuff that I write, it never gets it never gets old for me. That doesn't. I never ceases to like warm the cockles of my heart that I've written something that people like. So that it never gets tiring. I'll talk about it forever. I don't care.
Thanks to David, Evelyn, and Grant for speaking to me for the sound test. But thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to subscribe or follow on whatever platform you might be listening on. Grant has another 2 upcoming episodes in this series, on editions covering GoldenEye 007 and Mario & Rabbids Kingdom Battle. There will be a new podcast each week, with next week's falling into the madhouse of Aperture Science for a Portal and Portal 2 special. I'll be covering both games in another triple-stuffed episode with composer Mike Moraski, songwriter Jonathan Colton, and GLaDOS herself, Ellen McLean. All of our Patreon supporters can receive early access for a single dollar, so head on over to patreon.com/_secretcave if you'd like to pledge your support and hear next week's episode right now. Of course, This doesn't apply if you're already a patron and hearing this episode in advance.